This morning, I'm going to talk about Dogen Zenji's Fastful Uji, which means being time. So, the second paragraph is, the 16-foot golden Buddha body is time. The 16-foot golden Buddha body is time. And being is... The 16-foot golden Buddha body is time. Because it is time, it has time's glorious radiance. So the 16-foot golden Buddha body is a way that we talk about the Buddha in the Mahayana Sutras. So we talk about the Buddha being 16 feet tall, glorious, emanating a golden aura in the Mahayana Sutras. And he says, Dogen saying, well, this 16-foot Buddha body is time. And then he says, because it is time, it has time's glorious radiance. So this glorious radiance is also the radiance of time. So now we have, there's no difference between this glorious radiant Buddha, time, and time's glorious radiance. So then he says, you must learn to see this glorious radiance in the 12 hours of your day. So the 12 hours of your day in Chinese system, there are 12 hours in a day. So there's 12 increments during a day. So you could think of this as 24 hours in your day. So 24/7, as we would say now. Say 24/7, you must see this glorious radiance. Is he saying that we should see it as somehow outside of ourselves, better than us? We're looking for some glorious Buddha that's outside of ourselves? Or that our time has this glorious radiance of a Buddha? So he's actually saying the second. So he says, you have to see this glorious radiance in the 12 hours of your day, not someone else's day, not some idea about the day, not some sutra somewhere, but actually in your day. So he's not saying this is an object for something that you look for in your day. He's saying this is your day. Your day is also the 24 hours, the golden radiance of the Buddha. This is your time. But then he says the demonic asura, so these are demons, asuras are demons, the demonic asura with three heads and eight arms is time as well. Okay. He says, it can be no way different from the 12 hours of your day. So now he's told us that not only is the Buddha's golden radiance 12 hours, the 24/7 of our days, but so is the demonic asura is the 24/7 of our days. So we could understand this to mean that the 24 hours of our days is realization. The Buddha, the golden radiance, is realization. We could understand it to mean the 24 hours of your day is delusion. So he's saying that both are coexisting simultaneously. So let's assume that both are existing simultaneously, which for the most part we don't like the idea of that. What we like the idea of is the 24 hours of our day is the 8-foot golden radiant Buddha. But the demonic asura definitely should stay under a rock somewhere. We really don't want the demonic asura. And yet, Dogen's saying, both of them are part of your day. So that means that both of them exist simultaneously as being in time, being as time, being time. So the question I like to ask at this point is, when you're having being really skillful and really take care of your business, and you are the 12-foot, 8-foot golden Buddha, where is the demonic side? Where's the side in which we don't make, where we make horrible mistakes, where we do things and say things that are terribly unskillful? So if one side we have this kind of perfect person who's doing the right thing, which we all have that experience, right? And then there's this other side where we've made like horrible mistakes and we've all had that experience. So when one comes forward, where did the other one go? And when the other one comes forward, where did this one go? So they're both simultaneously present. It isn't like But we get caught in this or that dichotomy. We get caught in this sense of like, kind of like, okay, I'm in this moment of the radiant Buddha, but we normally don't say that to ourselves. We just, actually, often we ignore that moment. We do something that's really skillful. Sometimes we do something that's really skillful and we say to ourselves, yeah, he's that. Yeah, I did a great job. Or somebody else would come to us and say, yeah, you did a great job. And we think, yeah, that was good, you know. The other side, too, we mess up and we think to ourselves, whoa, that was, like, really bad. Like, we may remember that for the rest of our lives. You know, we're 40 years later, we think of it, we go, oh, goodness, you know. Actually, I think our tendency is to remember those things more than we remember the good stuff. So, but Dogen's saying, you know, they're both present simultaneously. So that's really hard for us to leave room for. Now, for me, the good news about this is not the radiant Buddha part, which is wonderful, but the fact that in the midst of the radiant Buddha, there is delusion, and in the midst of the delusion, there is still the radiant Buddha. So we really aren't in a state of black and white, even though we feel like we are. Which means that this radiant Buddha is completely accessible to us at any time. If we can cut through to the delusion of that moment, we can experience the radiant Buddha. Simultaneously, of course, delusion is always present in the midst of the radiant Buddha as well. So he's saying to us, have you thought about it that way? Have you thought about your experience in this way? So the 16-foot golden Buddha body is time. Because it is time, it has time's glorious radiance. You must learn to see this glorious radiance in the 12 hours of your day. The demonic Asura with 3 heads and 8 arms is time. Because it is time, it can be in no way different from the 12 hours of your day. Then he goes on to say, although you never measure the length and brevity of the 12 hours, their swiftness or slowness, you still call them 12 hours. He's setting up something here. I'm not sure that we don't measure the brevity or the length of our day. I certainly know for myself that at the end of the day, sometimes we say, whoa, that was like a very long day. Sometimes we say, that was a very short day. Or we've all had the experience in Zazen. That was a really short period of Zazen, or that was a really long period of Zazen. So maybe what he's saying is that it's very subjective. You know, that we have this very subjective experience about the nature of our being and time. So he says, you don't measure the length or brevity of the 12 hours, their swiftness or slowness, you call them the 12 hours. So the 12 hours, or the 24 hours, is in some ways very arbitrary, right? We have, like for example, we have daylight savings time, and we have time zones. The reason we have time zones is because of the railroad system. When railroads came in, people needed to know what time to be at the station. And it turns out that I think it's something like every, you know, oh, let me backtrack. Originally, people knew it was noon because the sun was directly over their head, right? That's when we know it's noon. So that's the kind of planetary event that happens for us at noon. Every 15 miles, I think, it changes. So, you know, obviously, as you move across the surface of the Earth, your relationship to the sun is going to be different. And so, actually, that noon time at different places will be at different times, right? So what they did is they set up time zones so that people could all say, oh, okay, it's noon right now. In this time zone, everybody agrees that it's noon regardless of what the sun is doing. So that's arbitrary, right? That's based on a kind of way in which we measure time because it's convenient for us, because it solves a problem for us, because it creates a situation where we can measure time in that way. But actually, time itself is not measured in that way. the physiological event of time is not actually how it happens. Really, for us, like in our bodies, time, we measure time. We look in the mirror and say, well, this has happened to me. I look in the mirror and say, whoa, you're looking older. You know, when I was younger, for a long time, almost into my 40s, I could go into a store and have people card me because I looked a lot younger than I was. So there's this way in which, at a certain point, people don't ask me for my ID anymore. So, what could that be about? So there's this way in which we have an internal sense of time, an internal sense of time passing, or this way that we can see on our faces the way our bodies feel. So those are lots of different ways that we can talk about how we actually do measure time and think about time. So then Dogen says, following his train of thought, because he's leading up to an idea here, he says, as evidence of their going and coming is obvious, the 24 hours of your day, you do not come to doubt them. So what he's setting up here is he's saying, you need to have a certain kind of doubt about the nature of your experience in order for you to investigate being time in a way that is helpful to your practice. So he says, as evidence of their going and coming is obvious, these hours in your day, you do not come to doubt them. But even though you do not have doubts about them, this is not to say that you know them. So here he's saying, you're not asking the right questions. He goes on to say, since a sentient being's doubting of the many and various things unknown to him are naturally vague and indefinite, in other words, if something is unknown to us, it's vague, it's indefinite, and we don't even know the right question to ask about the experience we're having. So he said he's setting this up, he's saying this, and then he says the course of your doubting that your doubtings take will probably not bring them, the doubting, to coincide with this present doubt. That's kind of a convoluted sentence. So he's using the gender he. The course his doubtings take will probably not bring them to coincide with this present doubt. Nevertheless, the doubts themselves are, after all, none other than time. What he's saying here is that even the doubts that you have, the questions that you have, if you're not asking the right question, will not create the kind of doubt that will cause a productive transformation in your practice. So koans are predicated upon this. Koans set up a certain kind of doubt, a question. They're created in such a way that that is a particular question that's aimed at a particular point of practice, and you do the koan with your teacher, and you don't even know the question. You don't even understand the question. Like, does a dog have Buddha nature? Moo. So the koan, the capping phrase is moo. Okay. So you go, moo. What does moo mean? Oh, moo means no. But that's not helpful. It doesn't matter that moo means no. So you have to keep at you, this doubt has to arise in you, this what's called a great doubt. In Christianity, it's often called the dark night of the soul. So this great doubt, in which this doubt, because you're now asking the right question, you're now investigating in a certain way, creates this sense of uncertainty, this sense of openness, this crack in your reified notions about this. You're now asking the right question, you now have the right doubts, and then you can go forward in your investigation. So Dogen's saying, we don't even ask the right questions about the relationship between what we call being and time. And when we start asking those questions, we will have this coinciding of the question. He says, since the sentient being's doubtings of the many and various things unknown to him, unknown to us, the things that are unknown to us, they're naturally vague and indefinite. That's why they're unknown to us, right? So we're like seeing a shadow, and we're trying to ask a question, to have a doubt, the shadow has to have some form. So it's like we're seeing this thing. We don't even understand what it is. We're looking at a table. We don't really understand, from a Buddhist point of view, what a table is. So we look at the table, and what we see is function. It's a table. It holds my papers. It holds this. It's something for me to use. But we don't see that it is also impermanence. We don't see that it's also completely interconnected with us and there's no difference. We don't see that it has its independent side called table, from, as the Tibetans say, from its own side, the tableness. We don't see it without the label. So because we're blinded by that, that means that we don't ask the right questions about the nature of a table. So this table, so it's, he says, and various things unknown to us are naturally vague and indefinite, and the course our doubtings take, so the questions that we will ask about the table, will probably not bring us to a time to coincide with the present doubt. And the present doubt is this moment. The present doubt is, what is it? What is it? So when we sit Zazen, in Soto Zen, we don't say to ourselves, what is it? What is it while we're sitting? But we keep coming back to the present moment. And that coming back to the present moment, that discipline, if you will, that willingness to wake ourselves up, allows these vague and indefinite thoughts, which is this kind of, in this case, the sort of, you know, to come into focus. And in Zazen, we don't verbalize a question to ourselves. The question is, though, is what is it? That's the question. But we don't say it to ourselves. We just keep coming back, coming back, coming back. And that coming back in and of itself will open up the answer to what is it. Even though we don't have to formulate the question for ourselves, we just have to do the activity. But we still have to put effort into the activity. So Dogen's now framing the question, and he's going to present to us what our effort should be in relationship to that question. Okay, so that's what's happening in this part of Uji, at the very beginning of Uji. So he said to us, you know, you don't get the question. And you're like so kind of wandering around in a fog on this particular issue that, well, now I'm going to tell you how this works, right? So it's a setup for the rest of the text. Says, nonetheless, the doubts themselves, okay, the very doubts that we have, the very wandering around, these vague and indefinite ideas that we may have, in and of themselves, they are none other than being time. So in and of themselves, they are still our current reality. So you could say, in a certain way, you could say, those being times, that's maybe, if we want to do this, we could say they're like the demonic asura. If we say that the fact that we don't have these doubts, they aren't clear to us, they are so vague, maybe they're delusion. We don't have to label them as delusion because Dogen's also saying they are also the golden radiance of the Buddha. And yet, we still are left with golden radiant Buddha, asura. And the truth of that is somewhere other than, somewhere not that. We say, in Buddhism, we would say something like, it is the Buddha, it is not the Buddha, it is both the Buddha and not the Buddha, it is neither the Buddha nor, how am I getting this? Well, it's neither the Buddha and not the Buddha. The point, this is called a tetralemma. In the tetralemma, there is no place that you can land. There's no place that you can land. So Dogen's saying you can't hold on to delusion and you can't hold on to enlightenment. There is just the doubt of the present moment. Just this. There is just this immersion in what is it? Just this right now. So then he says, we set the self out in array and make the whole world. So this is not a statement of grandiose, egocentric ideas, nor is it a statement saying that we just make up the world with our minds. This is saying when we array ourselves, when we To array means to align. When we array ourselves with all being, with who we are, I'll talk about it here next, when we array ourselves with that, then we allow the world to come forward and make us as we make it. It's a collaborative process. So, I talk about, I think, this a fair amount. In our understanding about impermanence and interconnectedness and interpenetration, one aspect of that is that there is no separation. Everything is completely interpenetrating. And from that point of view, you could say we are process. That we are part of a process. The process that includes the table and the trees and dogs and cats and anything that you can stick a label on and anything you cannot stick a label on. That's the totality of the world, worlding the world, as Dogen says later in Uji. That's the totality of this reality making itself. Making itself. So there's no, in Buddhism, there's no intelligent functioning thing, being or whatever, that's making things happen. It is this collaborative event of everything in the world making the world. So I'll digress a little bit here and say, this does not absolve us from the responsibility of carrying on the Bodhisattva path. The Bodhisattva path is, how do I array myself with this totality in such a way that my actions are helpful and not harmful? Now, we don't always know what that is, but that's our effort, right? That's our effort. So we're by talking about the world making the world, we are not absolved from our responsibility in taking our place as hopefully mature adults, sometimes, most of the time, the best that we can to enact, to be helpful, to help enact this. So, and we do this partly, you know, we do it because we understand that if we are in this completely interpenetrating interconnection with everything in the world, then why wouldn't we want to help in that way? Why wouldn't we want to engage the world in that way? Because we understand that it's not separate from us. So in a kind of Machiavellian way, you could say, yeah, what's good for them is good for me, so I'm going to be good to them because ultimately it's good for me. So that's a way to look at that. From a more altruistic point of view, we would say, you know, this is good. It's I want to be helpful in this way. It's not about my kind of personal desire at this moment if it does not align with what's good for the totality of the situation. And so then we start talking about no self, no inherently existing self. This no inherently existing self is a self that is our true nature. We are no self. We are not inherently existing beings. We are completely dependent on the working of the world for us to be alive. It's just like, and you know this, we all know this intellectually. It's like, what Don said, no man is an island. We're not islands. We're completely dependent upon the totality of this world to take another breath, to eat food, to wear clothes, whatever you can think of, you know? So the reality is, and this is Buddha nature. Buddha nature is, when we talk about Buddha nature and Soto Zen, we're talking about this process, this interconnected, interpenetrating beingness of everything making the world. Now, Dogen also says, while it is true that we are Buddha nature, and we are not potentially Buddha nature, we are Buddha nature. All beings are Buddha nature. While it is true that that is absolutely happening willy-nilly, no matter what we think about it, we still have to enact Buddhahood. Buddha nature does not come forward unless it's actualized. So that's our practice. We have to actualize our practice. Dogen says that practice realization, practice/realization. That's one thought. So we say, often we think of practice as there is practice. I'm practicing so I can become realized. In Soto Zen, we do not practice to become realized. We practice because it is an expression of our Buddha nature. We practice because that is the activity of a Buddha. And the genesis of our practice comes from our Buddha mind, which is completely, fully present. So this goes back to the golden radiance and the eight-armed, three-headed Asura. Presencing, always present, fully present. So this is hard. This is not about potential either. So in the way Dogen understands the nature of the world, this is not a potential. This is fully present all the time, which means that we can access it all the time. Right? So if we talk about sudden and gradual enlightenment, this way in which we can turn on a dime and express Buddha nature. You've all heard this example. Say you go and you're driving and you let someone in who's in a hurry or something, and you let them into the lane of traffic. This notorious thing down here, getting onto Highway 1 going south, where some people clearly are just totally confused that their lane suddenly turned into an entrance lane onto the freeway. Those of us who live here know to stay a lane over, and then some of us who live here know that they can keep going, barreling up there, and then cut in, right? You don't know who that person is. You know, I've had this thought. I don't know who that person is who's suddenly found themselves at the end of the lane, who either wants to get out of that lane or they want to get into that lane to get onto the freeway. I don't know what their motivation is. I don't know whether there's somebody who's terribly confused, doesn't live around here, has no clue what's going on, and is totally freaked out that suddenly they're being forced onto the freeway, or whether it's somebody who's figuring out, oh, the traffic's really bad, I'll go up to the front of the line and cut in. You know, it's like, who knows? It doesn't matter. What matters is for us as bodhisattvas is what is our response? Can we have a response of equanimity and generosity in that moment? So that moment of equanimity and generosity, that's Buddha. That's your Buddha mind. So it can be very prosaic like that. It doesn't have to be something special. We don't have to go to another country and save people from Ebola. It's good to do that. If that's your path, it's great. Please go and do that. But the hard things of practicing no-self is happening every day in our lives. That's the hard no-self. Not the grandiose visions we have about how we're going to go out and save the world by doing something really extraordinary. It's like, what are you doing when you're walking down the street? What are you doing when you're at the supermarket? What are you doing when we're relating to each other? What are we doing when we're talking to our partners? What are we doing when we're at work? How are we being with each other? When it's not a fantasy, it's like you're just totally annoyed at something that's going on. And how are you going to be generous in that moment, appropriately generous? People always say when I say this, say, well, what if somebody's abusing? We're not talking about that. We're talking about you're just annoyed. You know, you don't like this person. So in that moment, can we drop the self? Can we be generous? Can we have what Dogen calls parental mind? Parental mind is not the mind of you should, like this. Parental mind is that mind of generosity, that mind of, oh gosh, this little kid's about to run out on the street, I'm going to grab him and keep them from getting hit by a car. That mind of knowing that children maybe are not so cognizant of their effect they're having in the world. And so you give them space to run around the restaurant, even though you may be thinking to yourself, why don't those parents get their kid? You know, but this space, it's not the child's fault. The child's just being a child. So I don't want to take this analogy too far, but that we have this mind of a kind of generosity, this parental mind of generosity. When we set ourselves out in array, we make the whole world, we allow the world to come forward as the 16-foot golden Buddha body. when we array ourselves in this moment of being and experiencing that, we can actually see the world in a different kind of way. We make the world in a different kind of world, and the world makes us. It's a process of reciprocity. He says, we set the self out in array and make the whole world. We must, and also, by the way, in Japanese and Chinese, this who is making the world is unclear. So the translator here said, we set the self out in array. But it can also be translated as the self sets the self out in array. So it doesn't happen, we, it's this thing of I'm doing something. Right? Separate. I am separately doing something that's going to make this other thing happen. But actually, it can be translated in a way where it's more ambiguous, where it's more about we align ourselves and we allow the world to come forward and meet us. In Genja Koan, Dogen says, you know, to carry the self forward is delusion. To allow myriad things to come forth and reveal themselves is realization. To allow things to come forth and meet you is realization. So we have a tendency to set ourselves forward. I want this. This is my idea. This is how it should be. This is, you know, very black and white. Not having the right doubts. Right? And then we have this very rigid notion of what's going on. He's saying that's carrying the self forward. And I'll just add inappropriately. Okay, so that's carrying the self forward in a way that's not particularly helpful. But when we don't do that, when we stay more open, step back a little bit, it's kind of like listening. You know, you're having a conversation, you're thinking about, what am I going to say next? So you're just like, bang, 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 bang. But if we actually step back and give some space and listen and don't let ourselves have just completely fill in the blanks in our head and immediately go to our own agenda, we might actually hear something from the other person. Or if we don't like somebody, immediately the defenses go up. I don't like this person, I can't even hear them. We can't hear them, whatever they have to say to us. They might actually be saying something different, like, oh, I'm sorry, or I'm in pain, or I'm suffering, or whatever it is. But we don't see that because all we can think about is what's going on in our own heads. So he says, to carry the self forward is delusion. To allow things, myriad things to come forth is realization. To allow myriad things to come forth is to set the self out in array and to make the whole world. We may see all the various things of the whole world as so many times. So here he's saying that things, being, time, same thing. So what we have here is we have, I want to digress for a minute and talk about something called the Dharma position. The Dharma position, it would be a thing, let's say, you know, this watch. The watch has its own being as a watch, totally separate. Dogen says in Genja Koan, there's a watch has a before and after, but it's just got this moment of being. We are individuals. We exist. So we have this before and after we exist. We also exist in this totality of this relationships of complete interconnectedness. And then from that perspective, we are, if you looked at us from outer space and you couldn't see any human beings on the earth, you would just say earth, right? Earth. And that word earth, and this is the whole idea behind Gaia theory, right, is that there's just this thing called Gaia that's doing its thing, and that includes us. So from that perspective, that in that this story, there's still this thing called Gaia. But in this idea, there's this way in which we completely are separate in the sense that we are not separate, and yet simultaneously we are not part of the, we are still part of the whole. We're still part of this complete interconnected, interpenetrating whole that we'll call the world. Arbitrarily, we'll just call it the world to give it a definition. So those two things are happening simultaneously, plus change the impermanence of change is happening all the time because of all these interconnected relationships. And those interconnected relationships, for us, what we see is a timeline, right? We see past, present, future. But actually, all those things are interconnecting with each other in a way that we cannot even define the beginning and end of that. Does that make sense? No? So we're being asked to hold these kind of ideas simultaneously. So sometimes it's appropriate for us to say, oh yeah, I'm part of a really big picture here. I'm working in a committee and I'm part of the whole committee. So that we're functioning as a group. Sometimes we function as individuals in that committee. We say, I have this idea, you know, blah, blah, blah. I think it's really, this is, you know, here I am as an individual presenting this thing. And simultaneously, these decisions are being made that include the totality of everybody's life that's there and all the experiences they've had. And those decisions, which we think have a definite define it of, this is a decision we made on Thursday afternoon when we were at the meeting, and yet that decision holds really the totality of all being simultaneously in that individual moment of the decision. So we don't think about it that way. We just say, I made a decision. So, but that decision and that committee and that individual and that piece of paper and that pen and everything about that, each one of those things simultaneously make up the world, as well as the fact the world is each one of those things simultaneously. And there's not any, and it has its individual moment of pinness, personness, decisionness, all simultaneously happening. And it's all in flux. It's like, ugh. So, in some ways, going back to this question about doubt, question about asking questions, one of the things about practice is learning how to ask the right question at the right time. This is a question about this moment of coming forward as an individual, this moment, this Dharma position of my, you know, isness. Is this a moment of coming forward, recognizing that I'm in this complete totality of an interfunctioning system? You know, on a really practical level, if you're like a whistleblower, right? You're working in an environment where you think something really bad's going on. You say to yourself, okay, this individual believes that something really horrible is happening and I need to do something. I need to carry myself forward in this situation because this is the right, appropriate thing to do. Or is this the time that I incorporate myself into the whole and see that aspect of who I am? And it's not the right time. There's actually not something going on here that needs to be brought forward in that way. It would be unskillful. It's actually not helpful for me to do that. I'm doing it because I'm mad at my boss. Right? Something like that. So how do we discern which thing that is? So we're being asked to make these discernments. That's part of what our practice is about. Is this the discernment of the individual Dharma position? My Dharma position? Me here? Bang? Is this the moment of discernment of all beings simultaneously coming forward? One of the ways we do that is that we have this doctrine of no self. We look at who we are. We look at what our relationships are. We look at our suffering. We look at our suffering. We say, where is this suffering? What is this about? What am I holding on to? How is it, you know, how am I caught? So we're being asked to do that. And in practice, one of the ways we do that is, in some ways, we set up these arbitrary activities that we're engaged in that push our buttons, you know. We sit zazen together, we do work periods together, we follow a schedule together. We do these things. We have certain forms. We gassho certain ways. We, you know, do in service. We're doing all these various things. Everybody has their part that they do. And, you know, if you put yourself in that situation, your resistance comes up and you get to look at that. And the thing that's nice about the practice is that basically it's harmless. You know, whether you turn to the right or the left is harmless. But on the other hand, it tells you a lot about who you are and where your mind is and what's going on for you in that moment. Everybody's turning right. You're like going, I don't want to turn right. I want to turn left. How come I have to turn right? Who made up these forms anyway? It's like, what's this about? I don't have to do this. This is a bunch of silly stuff. Oh, it's cultural. You know? Or you say, I know how to turn right and not left. I am so good at this. I am such a good practitioner. You know, I think I'm enlightened. And now I'm going to tell everybody else how to do it. You know, so it's like all of these things come forward. And in this fairly harmless and benign situation, we get a chance to look at it. You go to your teacher and you say, you know, I just can't believe it. So-and-so always turns left when we're supposed to be turning right. Like, what is their problem? You know, it's like, well, don't they know? I've told them so many times that they are supposed to turn this other way, and they don't do it. And the teacher says, maybe you should look at what's going on with you, not what's going on with them. You know, so the teacher's job is to say, look over here. You're not even asking the right question. The right question is over here, right? The doubts that you have over here about this other person's practice, actually, those are not the right doubts. Those are not the doubts that you want to have. The doubts that you might be having would be about, say, what you're up to. So this is this environment where we can engage our practice in this way that is, I think, for the most part, very wholesome. All right, I'm going to stop. To be continued. Thank you very much.